Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival Programs brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James is, he lives in Japan, been there for 10 years or more, and if you're interested in an intellectual perspective on what's happening in the world, visit the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James, how are you doing?
Well, to be honest, I'm always a little bit nervous coming on with you, Alfred, because I never know what direction you're gonna take this week. So I'm always trying to bone up on and study every possible story you might bring up, and I always get it wrong. So I'm always excited to see what we're going to talk about.
I think you're prepared for all of this. I think you've probably... I'm not sure if you've had a computer grafted into your brain or an internet connection or something like that, but I know I am hard-pressed to find a subject to talk about where I can expect you to be completely lost and say, what the heck is he talking about?
Let's give it a try.
I've got one here from the, what is this, China Daily Mail? Let me just scroll up at the top, take a look here. Yeah, China Daily Mail. And the headline is, China changes its strategy towards Japan. Unrelenting pressure has produced far greater costs than benefits for China. Does that sound like an accurate description of what's happening with China policy to Japan? And what do you think about China in general? They're building islands, or in the South China Sea, if I understand correctly, that they intend to 1,000 miles offshore. I don't know if it's that far, but certainly several hundred miles offshore. They're building islands in the ocean that they will claim for themselves. What's happening with China right
you
now?
You are correct about that. What was the quote from that article?
Well, the headline is, China changes its strategy toward Japan. Unrelenting pressure has produced far greater costs than benefits for China.
Hmm.
Are they easing up on Japan right now? Do you perceive that or hear it?
I would say there's been certainly a bit of a detente. It's from 2012 or thereabouts where we saw the real heating up over the island dispute in the East China Sea, the Senkaku Islands, as they're called in Japan. There was obviously a lot of pressure building up over that, and we saw some big protests, some anti-Japanese protests in China, some nationalist sentiments here in Japan. So we saw a lot of that being whipped up at the time. And I think that was perhaps related to Xi Jinping being relatively new in power at the time and trying to establish his authority and his control over the people. But the best way to do that is always to direct them at a boogeyman. And then on the other side, you had Abe was campaigning at that time, and his base is really that nationalist base in Japan. So I think they were both playing to political crowds, and I think that might have been part of the reason why it seemed to be fanning, the flames were being fanned at that time, and perhaps part of the reason why that's been backed off since then. I think there's still, of course, there's regular stories about Japan scrambling jets to deal with Chinese fighter jets that are straying into their space, and all that sort of thing still continues to happen, but it's not really the pressing issue that it was back a few years ago, and it's not being trumpeted and played out in the media quite as much. So I think there's been a backing off. And I place it more within that political context, although I'm sure there are probably other reasons for that as well.
Well, here's one of the reasons. The article says Japan's direct investment in China fell by 38.8% year on year in 2014 to $4.33 billion. So Japan had been investing in China, presumably trying to make ties that would make military conflict improbable and something people wouldn't want to get into. I'm guessing, but I would, you know, do you think that's a reasonable guess?
Yes. Well, there may even just be straight economic reasons for not wanting to invest in China at this time. Obviously, there has been that slowdown in the export-heavy economy of China as it tries to struggle to perhaps make a transition to more of a domestic-based economy. So it is, I think, a less attractive investment than it has been over the past 15 years. So I think there may just be straight economic reasons for not wanting to put so much capital into China at this time. And that's exacerbated by those kind of political tensions that we know are...
But they might be misinterpreted to be a result of the political tensions rather than the fact that Japan is short on cash.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I got another one here from... what's this? World Politics Journal. European Central Bank's asset purchases program helps to end the Eurozone's four-month spell of deflation. I'm just interested in whether you think the ECB, the European Central Bank, is actually, have they paid in enough money, injected enough money into the European economy to end deflation? And do you see the economies of the globe tending more for deflation, or are we going back to inflation? What do you think is more likely?
Well, there is, as we've talked about before, there is definitely a deflationary undertow right now. And obviously what the past 5 years or so has been about is this attempt to inflate the bubble faster than it's deflating. And so we've seen unprecedented, literally world historically unprecedented amounts of money being created through all of these unconventional monetary tools by various central banks. And in fact, China looks like it's going to be the next to engage in this, as we say, its export-driven economy is being hurt right now by the fact that they haven't been able to devalue the yuan in the same way that Japan has devalued the yen, and the euro has been devalued, and the US dollar has been attempted to be devalued. So now, apparently, China is going to start either engaging in some quantitative easing or engaging in basically a type of bond collateral deal with some of the banks that may or may not buy some municipal bonds that are being issued to basically try to alleviate some of the debt burden that China is getting into. All of which is very fascinating. The question, of course, is the ECB's actions and their QE program that's just kicked off. Is this really going to be what gets the Eurozone out of its deflationary cycle? I remain incredulous. I think that it may have that cosmetic effect, and it may have a real effect on the markets per se in the coming year or two, but I think it's going to be exactly a similar situation to the Federal Reserve's QE program, which of course is the one that is the example that they're all following, that the playbook that they're all reading from. And in that example, we did have the Federal Reserve, of course, stepping in with its trillions and trillions that it created and used to buy bonds and mortgage-backed securities and other things. And that did have an effect of at least preventing the great deflationary cycle from all the deleveraging that was going on. But
so far.
Exactly. But of course, now that they've at least taken their foot off the gas pedal, as we've talked about with the ending of the QE program, and are now actually apparently going to put it on the brake with the inflation rate adjustment that supposedly is going to come this year, I think we're going to see the ultimate failure of the QE program, because at the end of the day, all of these central bank tricks are really just ways of trying to get people convinced that the environment is safe enough to start spending and investing capital again. And I don't think any amount of European central bank trick is going to convince the European public of that when they see and they feel the reality of what's happened over the past several years on the ground each and every day. We still have ridiculous amounts of unemployment amongst the youth, especially there in the southern European so-called pigs countries. We still have the fiasco of Greece continuing to unfold. And the latest, of course, was that Greece was allowed to use some of their reserve holdings as a payment against their IMF, their latest IMF payment. Which they will now have to replace.
They don't have any more.
Exactly. Well, they have to replace that back into their reserve holdings 1 month from now. So all they've done is kick that down the road another month. And this will continue to play out. My prediction would be that there will not be a Greek exit from the Eurozone anytime in the foreseeable future, not because of economic reasons. I mean, it should have happened. They never should have been allowed in the first place, even by the Eurozone's own rules. But I don't think it'll happen for economic reasons. I think it won't happen because of the geopolitical reasons. And Dr. Mark Fauber of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom report put this very well recently in an interview where he was talking about how the fact that basically Europe and NATO specifically needs Greece as the bulwark against the so-called Russian threat, and they're not going to let them get out of the Eurozone sphere of influence at all. It's just not going to happen. And I tend to agree with that. I just don't think they're going to allow it. So they'll do whatever tricks and chicanery. But still, people, especially in Greece, obviously see through that. There's no fundamental confidence that's being restored in the markets. All that people are doing is seeing that, oh, they're going to paper over this problem. And I don't think that's the fundamental basis for the real kicking off of true economic growth again. So there are cosmetic effects. There are sort of effects that happen simply from the printing of the paper, but I don't think it's a lasting effect. And as soon as they stop with their, you know, funny money from heaven, it's going to be exactly like in the U.S. situation.
I mean, if I understand correctly, Greece has dipped into its an emergency fund to pay off $780 million or thereabouts just in the last day or so. And that essentially, according to some reports, has left them basically penniless. They may be able to collect more money as time goes on. You know, they can collect more taxes. But it's interesting to me to compare $780 million, if I understand correctly, paid off in the last week, last few days, maybe just in late yesterday, I don't know. But versus the total size of the remaining size of the Greek debt is about $330 billion. Now, they're having all they can do to pay off $780 million. That's like a third of a percent, less than a third of a percent of their total debt. And it just tells us whatever, it tells me at least, that whatever is going to happen in Greece, there's just no way they're going to pay that debt. They may remain a part. They may never get to a Grexit. They may remain a part of the European Union from now until, you know, hell freezes over. But they're not going to pay that debt, or at least that's the way it appears to me. Do you disagree?
I don't see a way of it mathematically occurring anytime in the foreseeable future. I don't see how they're even going to continue to meet their payments. I think it's going to have to be restructured. And I don't think that's going to be a dramatic default, because that would be the type of thing that would potentially kick off some sort of political crisis in the Eurozone that can't really be papered over in the same way. So I think they're going to have to reach some sort of agreement. But that agreement, however it comes and in whatever form, will undoubtedly just cement and further ensconce the bankster's chains around the neck of the Greek people. And again, of course, all of this is in service to the kleptocrats in the Greek government, who were busy plundering off the wealth of the country for a very long time and manipulating it into the Eurozone in the first place with the help of Goldman Sachs and all those manipulations and deceptions that took place. It has nothing to do with the Greek people themselves, but they're the ones who are left holding the bag, and they're the ones that are going to pay for this. And unless there's some sort of political revolution, nothing's going to happen.
Are they really going to pay for it? And what I mean by that is this: I'm reminded of Iceland. Smaller, tiny little country. It's more like one city rather than a whole country. But just the same, there's an interesting principle. They were caught in a similar bind. They owed too much money, and they just told the creditors, too bad, we're not paying. And they went through 2 years, difficult times. They were back on their feet after about 2 years of just refusing to pay the debt. And now they are one of the more prosperous economies that are associated with Europe. They're doing fine. I can't help wondering what would happen if Greece just said, that's it, we quit. We're not paying. We don't need any deal. We will suffer through 18, 24 months of this. And creditors will say, why don't we lend to Greece? They don't have any debt. Once they wipe out all of the debt they have right now, they become a pretty good candidate for borrowing. Now, it'd be high rates and whatever, but I'm wondering, would Greece do better to just say, to heck with it, we're done with this, we're not going to try paying it, sorry about that, but we don't have the money, and we can't pay, so we won't pay, and let's all get on with our lives. Will Greece collapse into a decade-long depression? Or do you think they could have a couple of bad years and get back on their feet?
Well, it is a different situation than Iceland, which, for all of the seeming similarities, was a different situation insofar as the creditors that they supposedly owed their onerous debt to was were there was no real enforcement mechanism in the same way that we have the direct ties of Greece into the Eurozone, into the IMF, to the people sitting at the table with them. So I think there's more of a direct sort of leverage that they have over Greece right now, simply because they're part of these institutions and they've been involved in this process. I think repudiation of the debt as an onerous debt, as a debt that an odious debt, I should say, it should happen. I think that's the only real quote unquote solution to this problem. It's not even a happy solution in itself, because it will lead to pain for the Greek people, and it would lead to the Greek exit from the Eurozone, which would require, well, it wouldn't require, but it would undoubtedly lead to the creation of the recreation of the drachma, and that would be backed up by bonds issued by the Greek government, and there would be vulture funds that would come in to buy up those bonds at exorbitant rates.
They won't be doing them a favor. They will be.
Yeah.
They'll pay a high rate of interest, but just the same, they'd be able to get loans after they wipe out the existing debt.
I think they would, but I think it would only be the sort of vultures that would be buying them, and yes, the rates they would be extracting would be exorbitant. It would be a lot of pain for the country, there's no doubt. I mean, there's no happy ending to this.
Well, that's going to happen one way or
exactly.
the other.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
They're going to go through pain, and the only question is, how long is it going to last? How deep is the will of, what is the magnitude of the pain, and what is the duration? Those are the two questions, I suppose. Let's take a break for some commercials. I'm Alfred Addis, here with James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis, here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report on Financial Survival. And James said he was a little bit concerned sometimes about the questions I might ask. I've got one here that you may not want to answer. And I can understand that, and I don't object. If you'd rather just duck this question, that's fine. But here's an article from Newsmax, and it says, Americans living abroad set record for giving up citizenship. Now, you've lived in Japan for at least 10 years, if I understand correctly.
That is correct.
And it's none of my business as to whether you have yourself expatriated, or if you've considered it, or you've rejected the idea. And if you don't want to talk about it, that's fine with me. I'm not really interested in this. I mean, it's maybe interesting if you want to respond to it. But I'm interested. You're sitting out there. You must know other American expatriates. What do you think about the idea of expatriation?
Well, I am perfectly happy to talk about it in my own case. I am officially a Canadian citizen. At least that's what it says on my passport. So there you go.
Okay.
And I haven't given up my Canadian citizenship, because Japanese citizenship is not easy to come by, even if
I were interested
in it. So. But yeah. Yes, but there...
I thought you were a native of the United States.
I am not. I am Canadian.
I'm sorry. That was my mistake then.
A loyal subject of the Queen at the end of the day, so she would like to believe. But this is interesting, because the American example is particularly egregious, with the IRS claiming that it has the right to claim a portion of your income anywhere in the world, earned, you know, no matter where you're resident, which is quite unique. There aren't a lot of countries that do that, and Canada and Japan have reciprocal tax arrangements so that you can't double pay, basically. You're not double taxed. So the IRS is particularly unusual like that. And certainly I know a lot of Americans over here that have to deal with that. And some people have been quite frustrated by the fact that they're expected to pay tax twice, basically. So I certainly understand that. And it's interesting. I've been watching this for several years now. And it seems, I think every single year since 2009 or 2010, I've seen a story come out say this is the year more Americans gave up their citizenship than any year previous. And it seems every single year that's happening. So there's a growing trend toward that. And I certainly understand it, because, as I say, the IRS is really, it has its claws everywhere. And is working and has been working for some time to construct behind the scenes a web that makes it impossible for anyone to really evade the clutches of the IRS, as people have done in the past. And even the coveted Swiss banking secrecy and all of that has been undermined in recent years by agreements that basically mean that the IRS even has its eyes and ears in Switzerland now, in the Swiss banks banking system. And this is all being formalized now in the OECD rules that, or the OECD is trying to put something together to make this kind of international web. Of course, the idea is to catch these corporate tax evaders like the Apples and Microsofts or whatever, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. But just happens to be, by the way, yes, we can also peer into your personal bank account and get all your personal banking details anywhere in the world. So I understand why more people are doing this than ever before, but it's still, I mean, a fairly drastic measure for a lot of people. And interestingly, some people have some problems with this process. People may or may not have heard of Roger Ver. I've had him on the Corbett Report before. Basically, he's a Bitcoin proponent, and he lives out in Japan and has for a number of years. I'm not sure how long, but he was originally American. He gave up his citizenship and his passport, I believe, last year, and replaced it with a St. Kitts passport, I believe. And so he was attempting to go travel to the United States for a Bitcoin conference, and he was denied a visa to enter the United States because, the story is actually quite ridiculous, and they were claiming he didn't have proof of residence in the place that he has the passport or whatever, and they literally wouldn't physically accept his proof. He was trying to hand it to them, and they wouldn't accept it. It's a crazy story, but that's just one story among the thousands and thousands of people now that are in similar situations, giving up their U.S. citizenship to deal with the ridiculous taxation issues. And I think this is only going to increase from here on in.
You know, you raise an interesting point. I've listened to people talk about American citizens are taxed anywhere in the world. All right. And that is one of the primary motives that's causing them to relinquish their U.S. citizenship so they can live in Costa Rica, for example, and not be taxed by the government of the United States as well as the government of Costa Rica. That's all they're looking for. They're not just talking about dodging taxes or paying no taxes. They're saying, look, I don't want to pay taxes in two places. But that's the only way I've looked at this in the past. But what you're saying is that, and bringing to my attention, I hadn't thought about it before, it's not just about the individuals. It's about the corporations that are allegedly locating their headquarters, their finances, whatever, overseas. Multinational corporations, really, but if they are originally incorporated in the United States, are they also subject to being taxed by the United States government, even though they're located in Japan, for example?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think it just depends on how good your accountants and lawyers are. And obviously, the big corporations have the best in the world, so they know how to do mm-hmm. how to play this game. If you have, I mean, I'm not going to get into the particularities of this because I certainly don't deal with this corporate tax accounting. But my understanding is, if you have these various branches in different countries, what of that is actually created or is income that's generated by the U.S.-based corporation, and what isn't depends on where you keep the money and how it's moved between the various branches and things of that sort, so that you can have, like some corporations that get a lot of publicity, obviously, in the States, you can have these massive corporations that basically don't pay any taxes on any of their foreign-earned revenue because it's all part of these foreign subsidiaries and what have you. And again, I think it's really just a question of having accountants and lawyers and that know how to play the game effectively and probably have greased the skids with the right payoffs to the right officials that go along the way. So that's why I think the OECD initiative is disingenuous, to say the least. I mean, I'm sure there will be some corporations that end up, you know, getting at least wrist slapped through all of this and having to pay more in taxes. But I think my understanding of this is that this goes more towards the individual, because I think that the ultimate point of this is the creation of the global chat tax framework, without which you couldn't even possibly imagine having anything resembling some sort of global governmental structure. You need to have the framework to be able to track everyone's finances everywhere in the world and to have this sharing of information between governments. That has to be the real groundwork, the cornerstone of anything that would resemble a global governmental entity. And can you imagine, I mean, from that cornerstone, you can build all sorts of things. I mean, imagine if they bring in some sort of, you know, the United Nations carbon tax or whatever. Again, that sort of thing cannot be built unless you have that cornerstone laid of having the sort of global tax framework. And so I think that's really what this OECD initiative is about. I think that's what the IRS is trying to do with its Foreign Bank Secrecy Act and all of these other legislation that's being passed to basically make everything as transparent as possible to the government.
When we talk about the New World Order and global government, you know, it's a subject that a lot of people talk about. But who points to the source of it? Where does the New World Order, where is it headquartered right this moment? And what is the foundation for it? Which nation or nations are really pushing for the New World Order? And where I'm going with this is the United States, the central force behind the New World Order?
That's a difficult question to answer, because what do you mean by United States? But I would say no.
I get an award for that one. Stumped you a little bit on that question.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out the best way to shoot down your question.
We would think that the IRS, we think the IRS is trying to get taxes from Americans anyplace on the globe, right, just because the IRS is greedy for money.
Well, yeah, no. But no, ultimately, no. I think it isn't about that.
To establish, build a foundation for what the New World Order will take over. And if the IRS is ultimately working for the New World Order, where is the headquarters? Who are the
principals? You see, that's kind of the wrong way to frame the question, because it's not aware. We've been trained to think that the New World Order, the head people, whatever, are in a certain place, in a certain country, and they operate from there in that country's interests or what have you. It isn't about that at the end of the day. It's about certain families. It's about certain bloodlines, even, I'm sure, at the very top of this, that ultimately, I really don't think they care about anyone who isn't part of their little clique, whether they live in the same geographical area or not. So I don't think it is where is this located, and I wouldn't say the United States is the headquarters of this New World Order. It's certainly been the driving engine for military enforcement of and the creation of this financial infrastructure that that will lay the groundwork for the next stage of global government. But I don't think, again, I mean, the ultimate end of this is global, so I don't think that we can locate it in a particular place. It involves the collusion, and I don't mean that in a sense that these people are all 100% on the same page, but generally speaking, the collusion of people in various structures and secret organizations and what have you in every country in the world. I mean, there are people who collaborate and collude in various forms everywhere, all over the world, and they're important in their different sections of the world, so that a Rong Yiren or whoever in China may be some of the most important people in the Chinese oligarchy, and they collaborate with the Kissingers and the Rockefellers in America, and they collaborate with the Rothschilds in Israel, and they collaborate with the various groups and the roundtables and what have you in England. And again, I don't think looking at trying to see the one place or the one group that is doing this is the right way of seeing it. I think it has to come about through the collusion of people in all of these different places.
Well, the question becomes, the United States seems to be working to implement, engineer, cause a new world order. They seem to be a servant. The government of the United States, from my perspective, seems to be serving that objective. But if the government of the United States is not itself a prime mover, then they're a subordinate and somebody's pulling their strings, and they are working for. They're not the source of the New World Order per se, but they are a very important subordinate, and they're taking orders from. And it implies that our government has been captured by forces of the New World Order. And is that an exaggeration? Is it a misstatement? Or is it just something like an idea whose time has come.
Hmm.
Is that what we're dealing with the New World Order? Is it sinister? Someone's going to force this on us, or are we, you know, finally going to see global government?
You know, that's a really good question, and one that I would hope that the alt media would be raising more frequently, because it gets to an important part of this this whole story, which is there such a thing as this wonderful, amazing, you know, benevolent government that used to exist, but it's been corrupted and taken over by the New World Order crowd?
Or has always been corrupt and taken over?
Exactly. I mean, so ultimately,
they've been taken over, or have they always been taken over?
Well, the way I would see it is that the New World Order ideology, the globalist ideology, the idea that we have to all, you know, unify under this global government, which is the ultimate end of this, is just an outgrowth, is just an extension of the seeds, of the kernels of the idea that were contained in and of themselves in these national governments before them, and in previous forms of government before them. I think it is a growth of that idea. And so I don't think returning to, you know, the old, if there was some sort of, you know, pre-NWO government, if we could just return back to that, everything would be fine again. I don't think that's right. I think we have to question the legitimacy of the system itself to actually get at the root of the problem. So it's not, to me, it's not the corruption of something that was once pristine. It's just the growth of an ideology that that is just reaching a more and more elaborate form.
Do you think the New World Order is essentially a done deal? Is it inevitable? Or are there forces at work that are perhaps going to, you know, put a stick in their spokes and they're not going to pull it off?
If it was inevitable, I wouldn't be here talking to you. But it is certainly an uphill battle to fight against it. And it may just be a question that perhaps fighting against it can postpone it. And even that might be worth something. I don't know. But at the end of the day, I think there has to be a chance, honestly, a real chance to affect this. But the question becomes more pertinent, more to the point with every passing decade, because I think we get to that point where we are truly technologically reaching the sort of levels of control that wouldn't have been possible, imaginable a half a century ago, say. I mean, we couldn't have imagined really the type of technological tyranny that could be implemented by a global government 50 years ago, as opposed to what could be implemented today. And I think that gives a certain urgency to this problem. And especially when we start talking about technologies like the transhumanist technologies and things that will start to be the brain chips and what have you, that again sounded like science fiction fantasy half a century ago, but are becoming more and more an imminent reality at this point. I think those types of technologies truly will decide this match. I mean, if you want to look at it as sort of the people versus the small clique who have been in power, who have always been in power, there's always been a small clique over top of most people, but there's always been this sort of suggestion, well, we could fight them off, we could slough them off here and there, we can win battles.
Not only that, there was a suggestion that it wasn't going to happen until Flash Gordon arrived and the Emperor Ming, right, and that would be in the next century or something like that. It's turned out it's happening in our lifetimes. Mm. We're out of time, James. I want to thank you again for being on the program. I always look forward to it. And folks, thank you for tuning in. James and I will be back next Thursday, barring the unforeseen. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank the producer, and James Corbin. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay.